Okay, I'm here with Cameron McEwen again for our ninth session. The very first session was about the drama of cognition. Then we decided to look at my book, and this will be the eighth session on my book and the ninth session total. So Cameron asked me to explain my charts, and I'm always happy to do that. So we would go over to, if you're handy listening, go to ionandbob.com or ionandbob.blogspot.com. Either one gets there. And that's I-O-N-A-N-D-B-O-B, one word, ionandbob.com. And you would scroll to the bottom of the home front page, and you'll see at the very bottom, underneath the search area, verticals of all kinds of topics in red or orange. You would scroll down from the top. It says links in black, then the orange list, then another three words in black, popular ion posts. You go down those, oranges, and then the third one down, popular Bob posts. You'd go to 1, 2, 3, 4, Bob's charts. Down from the dark words, popular Bob posts, 40 Years in the Wilderness, the new coach shows, the Bob Show with Love Job, and then Bob's charts. Now, since these dialogues will go on and be prominent in history for millennia, for those that want to know who I was and what I did with my bride of 53 years, the top category there, popular Bob posts, we're in now, 40 Years in the Wilderness, lots of good photos there. And then of 1969 to 2009. So now you click on Bob's charts, and you scroll to the bottom of the charts that are presented to you, and you get to the bottom, and you will, where is this? The first chart, when you click on Bob's charts, is McLuhan's tetrahed, blah, blah, blah. Scroll down past that one, the next one, that's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So 12, 13, and 14, going down the vertical, 15. Would I say 12, 13, 14, 15? Those four are what we're going to deal with. So now at the bottom you'll see Bob Dobbs signing out chart. So go back up to number 13, Bob Dobbs' bottom-up chart. So this was made in 1985, and it was simple McLuhanism. You have the ground on the left side in green, and then across the top, the word figures. Now, bottom-up means, that was a popular phrase in the 80s, it's action, culture, growth, technology that comes from the people. Generally, somebody or a bunch of people, smart people, in a culture might make an invention of something. So that's bottom up.
And Bob, can I ask a question here? Does bottom up mean that the reality of the thing comes from the bottom? And that the top is a derivative?
Yes. The top down is the bureaucratic control in a culture of the effects of the technology or culture that's starting to become well used by the culture. In other words, a cliche. So when the printing press came in, as an example, came out of Germany, that brought in the ability to read the Bible privately. And eventually, you know, after a few years, people started to be able to get access to the Bible. And the Catholic Church in Rome, they objected to people reading this copy of the King James Version of the Bible. I don't know what Bible they were using in 1450, 1500, 1550. Anyway, so the Vatican said, we got to stop this. So they started a war against the Protestants. So that was top-down control, bureaucratic control, a medieval cultural institution that's unhappy with a new technology which creates a new culture, which changes us into a, well, beginning of mercantilism and then capitalism. So you see what I mean?
Yes, sir.
What top-down is?
But the, yeah, but we're, the chart that we're initially looking at, I believe, is the reverse of that, bottom-up.
Yes.
So I take it that bottom-up means that the force or reality comes from the bottom and shapes the top, and the inverse, the top-down, is what you were just explaining, where the force or reality comes from the top and shapes the bottom.
It tries to, yes.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, no, that's
and,
correct.
And that's, yeah, and so that, as I was hoping, that indicates to me that your charts capture somewhat of what I mean by the figure ground spectrum, namely that along the spectrum of possible figure ground configurations, according to McLuhan, the figure and ground can flip. And that it's very very important for McLuhan to understand in reading anything or viewing anything, to understand what sort of figure ground configuration is at stake for the thing that you're trying to understand. And I if I'm right about your charts, then that's kind of the idea behind them.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, because on the bottom-up chart, the upper left-hand corner, you have ground. And that's supposed to be in big words, big letters, you know, to stand out. And then to the right of it is figures. So that's supposed to show figure ground relationships.
And yeah, so exactly. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So, and ground, for the bottom-up chart, my first category, well, only category for ground is secret government. Now, what I'm saying there is in the first case, at the time of the phonetic alphabet and papyrus, this secret government was phonetic alphabet. It shaped people more than what bureaucrats were trying to do. You see that's what I mean? You see, it's a it's a bit of an ironic statement. So what you have is six types of cultural action, six figures affected by the phonetic alphabet and the papyrus. So the categories are from left to right are popular art form, highbrow art form, technological art form, popular archetype, in brackets, user as monarch of, which is an update of McLuhan's user as content, and then ghetto, what drops out, an older environment, and what's a major historical symptom. So these are simple, cliche, famous terms, famous people, famous phenomenon to give somebody an idea of figure ground. You know, back in 1985, not many people were skilled in thinking this way, right? McLuhan was not being made well known, kind of suppressed, and there was only a few people out there doing McLuhan or talking about him. So I was on the radio at the time, so I felt I had an audience, so I decided to make some teaching aids. So this is what this is.
Right.
So, now, so at the time of the... Go ahead.
Let me ask a question here. Am I right that the, for example, if you look at phonetic alphabet and papyrus, and you come across, you have Christ, Plato, and Aristotle, spoken word, tribe, family, and Caesar, the understanding of Christ or Christianity or Plato and Aristotle obviously varies over time. It varies for any one person over time. It can vary within a single text depending on what's being talked about or described. So when you use these terms, are you aware that these are sort of hand signals and are not definitive of something that doesn't change either over time or over interpretation or something?
Oh, yeah. They're meant to be cliches.
Yeah, okay. Good. Good.
I mean, I'm taking what people have heard of. Most Westerners know this stuff, North American, Europe, back then. They've heard these names, Shakespeare, Francis Bacon, Martin Luther. So, but you can work with cliches because you're using a ground which is a span of time, you know, several centuries. So it's vast generalization. It's like once Eric McLuhan's like last interview before his father died in April 1980, he said he was a specialist in generalities. He was being interviewed about his potential of taking over the Cochos, which was closed 2 months later. So these are generalities, or these are cliches that build to a generality. And I agree with McLuhan, you know, we had so much cultural information from 3,000, 5,000 years. He said you use the percept or the idea that the medium is the message to cover vast stretches of time. Right? Are you familiar with that idea, he said?
I can imagine him saying that, for example, when he talks about an ancient quarrel in modern America, he's obviously talking about something with great duration, starting at least in pre-classical Greece and coming up to the present time. But as you know, my feeling is that McLuhan's real contribution had to do with all-at-onceness, the big now. And so I prefer to speak about McLuhan in terms of the categories that don't change, right? And so I see one exercise that we're doing here of trying to sort of correlate my synchronic bias with your diachronic bias.
Yeah.
And I think what we're going to see is that they have very similar motivation.
Yep, I think so. So they're cliches. McLuhan says the phrase or the operation of the medium over a span of time. He says that in Counterblast. I don't have the page with me right now, but it's interesting. He says, in this world of 20th century information overload, generalities over huge spans of time are useful. And that was his objective on that level. Now, yeah, they could be sequential, but he would explain in other areas why the sequential falls away. But the sequential's there, you know, and you got to use books to talk to most people. So he laid it out when it was a linear way. So I'm doing that here. So what's interesting is I call Christ a popular art form, and I call Plato and Aristotle highbrow. You know, the educated elites are engaging the ideas of Plato and Aristotle and many other people, but they're the cliche. And McLuhan said anybody in the West, no, Coleridge said anybody in the West is either a Platonist or an Aristotelian. Remember that quote?
Right.
So,
yeah, and I was cited by McLuhan many times.
Right. So Christ is a popular art form for the educated, the Pharisees, you know, the hypocritical academics. Plato and Aristotle is what they're interested in. Technological art form. Now, I'm showing that it's going to be a previous environment, a previous technology, a previous ground. So phonetic alphabet and papyrus is the hidden ground. And so it makes a figure, the spoken word, and that's a previous hidden environment. And the spoken word, McLuhan said, as art form, was Plato's dialogues.
Yeah.
And so these are simple McLuhan points. But it's nice to have it on a chart. So then the popular archetype, and the archetype is an older environment, but it's gone past art form to archetypal status. And this is from a quote by Howard Gossage, And it's in first couple of first 10 pages of Hot and Cool, Gerald Stern's book that came out in 1967. He quotes, or just somehow, maybe it's an essay by Gossage, in the early pages, and he says, first something is the last word, meaning it's new and a novelty and striking. Then it becomes a cliche. Then it becomes an art form. Then it becomes an archetype through use. So I am presenting the archetype at the time of Christ is the tribe. User is monarch of. The tribe is the organization that is at that point confronted with the phonetic alphabetized individual. So it's the new phenomenon, it's the new threat, it's a new novelty, and it's up against the archetype of the tribe, which had been around a long time. Okay?
Sure.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so that's the tribe has the same relationship with phonetic alphabet and papyrus as the spoken word does. Just the spoken word is, as you say, the technological art form, and the tribe is what might be called the social art form.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so then the ghetto or the dropout is the family, which, I mean, families are always around, but with the individual becoming a new factor, the family gets lost in the shuttle. So that's why the Christ and the mythology of the Holy Family, like that super archetypalization of something that is being wrecked. I mean, if you look at Fellini's movie Satyricon, any of these historical movies of Roman era, there's always families being killed, wiped out, you know, for larger either phonetic goals or historical army conquering space goals. Family gets beat up bad. So it's interesting that Christ represented the Holy Family or came out of a idealized situation of the family, right? You get that?
Yeah. Absolutely. I can add what I think is an interesting note to that. And that is that when Eric Havelock, was teaching in Toronto, which he did from 1929 to 1946, and in 46 he had 1 year of overlap with McLuhan, although Havelock was mostly at Harvard that year as sort of a trial lecturer.
Mm-hmm.
But his family remained in Toronto, and Havelock was sort of going back and forth. And he held some public lectures in Toronto, which were influential at least to Innes, but I think also to McLuhan. Now, what's interesting to me about 1946 and the relationship of Havelock and McLuhan is that when McLuhan came to Toronto, he came as an historian of Western education, because that's what he had written his PhD thesis on.
Yes.
So he came to St. Michael's, and he was in the English department, but that was his specialty. And Havelock's specialty in those years was education in Greece from, let's say, 525 to 375, something like that. Havelock had been publishing on this topic for more than 10 years in 1946. He had been going to meetings of the Modern Language Association and had been giving lectures on how education had changed from sort of pre-classical Greece to what happened with Plato in the Academy and Aristotle in the Lyceum. So the notion that Havelock put forward is that education up until, let's say, 500, or I should say up until around 400, was family-based. And that the way somebody learned about something was up until a certain age, they would learn what their father was doing. And then, let's say at 15 or something like this, they would go to a related family and they would learn something else. And by going to this other family, they would both learn other skills, but also learn how to change their mind a little bit, get into a different mindset.
Mm.
But everything was family-based.
Yeah.
And so for Havelock, the big change that was introduced by Plato and by some of the sophists was the idea that there is a kind of general learning that you can get into that isn't family-based. And so as I see it, that accords very well with your chart here.
Yes.
That these, what you're highlighting are things that had been unconscious up until this time, and now they become conscious in a strange way where they both intrude on consciousness, but also become relativized.
Yes. Very good. So I'm calling that, it's sort of like part of the obsolescence phase of the tetrad. It's dropout. But it's not, the obsolescence phase, according to McLuhan, is quite prominent, more and more of something. It's just not constitutive. There's that word.
Right.
So there's
right. It's losing its whole.
Its whole. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that.
Hold. H-O-L-D.
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's losing its hold and it's kind of vulnerable. It's a ghetto. It's kind of forgotten socially. So
yeah.
then the symptom, the historical cliche, symptoms plural, I have another figure, is some phenomenon. And geez, everybody knows about Caesar, right? So Caesar is a new kind of leader for the space-based societies, using Innes' categories, like Rome, where they conquered space with Rhodes and papyrus. What else say about that? They were a new phenomenon with the Rhodes and paper or papyrus against the traditional time-based societies like Sumerian, Babylon, and these civilizations that didn't spread over space supposedly very much. They stayed within the walls, and the priests controlled time. So Caesar is a new symptom for the time of Christ and the phonetic alphabet and papyrus. So once you see what I'm doing, it's pretty straightforward. What's interesting may be what I pick. Popular art form, Shakespeare. Now, Shakespeare himself, you know, it's argued over whether he wrote the plays or he just produced them on the fly as a playwright in London. So the sophisticate of his time was Francis Bacon, the philosopher, the grammarian, all kinds of things, the scientist. He's a big deal. He's even, isn't he ex-chancellor of the Exchequer? I think he is.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So he's the intellectual elite, and he's up against Shakespeare. The technological art form is that medieval form, the manuscript, that's been going on for centuries. It is the technological art form at the time of the new environment of print. So it is translated, affected, altered, and also more of them are available with print for people. And then the village is starting to lose its ground influence because people are traveling. They have They have new visual markers, compasses and that, to move across the oceans. And they end up attacking other villages by other races who are not at the beginning of industrialization with the printing press. And so the dropout in that case is the tribe, and a symptom is Martin Luther King. I mean, Martin Luther, rather, founds the Protestant religion. So do we need to go through them all? Do you see the pattern? It's pretty simple.
No, I can see it, and it does agree with my figure ground spectrum quite closely, and I didn't understand that before. I suspected that it might be the case, but now that I can see that it very much is the case. You're dealing with shifts over time that need to be accounted for by anything like what I call chemistry. It's not enough to say that, let's say, water is hydrogen and oxygen. You also have to be able to say what happens when you put water and iron together. And that's that has a side that has to do with formulas that are always the case, but it also has to do with a progression in time.
Yes.
And so you can't separate the formulaic, which I tend to talk about, from the progress through time, which you can talk about. So I think they go together well.
Yes, and I use the word formula in the next phase. I point that out. Okay, so what I sort of what's clever is who I pick. You know, Dickens, well-known phenomenon, a new kind of phenomenon in the newspaper age, his popular level of success. But the intellectuals are Darwin and Marx. They shape people. They're new. And the printed book becomes a novel or an art form. The town drops out. Or rather, you're from a town. Towns are cliche. But the village drops out. And you have a symptom is the inhuman effect of industry is starting to bother people. So Luddites are a famous response. Also symptomatic of failure to stop their failed resistance. So you have to know who Al Capone is in the early part of the 20th century. You have to know who Einstein and Freud and James Joyce are to get that one. But the mafia is a phenomenon, a decentralization that the telephone electric environment makes possible. And they bypass the literate, respectable legal institutions. So I like having Al Capone in there. Now that's the global village. The global village is, 2,000 years old or more. We don't realize how much people traveled in 2,000 years ago, all over the place. You know about that, right? So
yes, sir.
It's a global village.
And even before.
Yeah.
Nowadays we're learning that the Neanderthal, for example, traveled from Europe to China.
Yes.
And that is maybe 50,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago. So human beings having a nomadic lifestyle is sort of at the very foundation of things.
Yes. So I'm probing McLuhan, taking his cliche that the global village, is in the 20th century, and said, no, it's way back there. It gets more intense through the centuries, but a big shift happens with the global theater. So even though television is starting to be used in the late 40s, early 50s in the United States, the effect of the global theater is coming because people are starting to fantasize about space. There's meetings with enthusiasts. My friend Dr. Beter was one of the leaders in these meetings, and he got to meet in the 50s. He's born 1921, So he's 30 and 51. So in his 30s, he got to meet Wernher von Braun and some of the guys in Huntsville, Alabama, that become important with the space movement in the late 50s, early 60s, you know. So the effects of the satellite starting to lurk, starting to be there. So I'm saying, look, we're in a new context when you look at television and computer and satellite. So that's my innovation on McLuhan's cliche pattern. You know what I mean? Cliche McLuhanism. People don't even know about global theater in the 60s, not till the early 70s that they start to hear about it, if at all. So I'm showing the mosaic cross-cultural action of things, the interplay of figures due to the pressures of the ground. And so television comes in, and you got more phenomena. What is happening? You've got movies and radio, so you're going to have two popular art forms, Elvis and Fellini, as examples. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Let me just ask about Global Village and Global Theater. Could we say that the Global Village has nature as ground, and the Global Theater has moved beyond nature to a satellite environment?
Yes, that's what I mean. The Global Theater, that's what I'm saying. It's thought about in the 50s before 1957, when Russia puts the Sputnik up. People their imaginations are moving out into the solar system. And that's, maybe McLuhan would say, that's the effect of radio, because you are in a strange new membrane with the radio environment. You're not even in terrestrial scenarios. Where are you with radio? So people, you can see filling in, okay, I'm quite expansive. I'm in Wisconsin, I can hear radio all over the world in shortwave. My awareness is pushed out, and then I might start looking at solar system more than I did, 100 years before. And that gets into science fiction. So the effects are preceding the causes, and you're going to see that developed in later charts, the effects preceding causes. But existentialism was a highbrow philosophy. Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, the French writer. And on the technological level, you got two are becoming art forms, radio and movies. Definitely radio as an art form is teen music, rock and roll, right? A whole new audience is created out of an environment that's sort of sidelined by television. And movies become an art form, especially in France. Remember all those great French directors of the 1560s, Truffaut,
sure,
Godard? They thought Jerry Lewis was an amazing art form. You know what I mean? It was a joke to Americans, but the French were bringing a different sensibility and a bit outside of the process, so they looked at movies differently, and they moved into art form. And the nation is dropping out as the globalists, the internationalists start working the whole planet. The Rockefellers are flirting with the Soviet Union and other things all over the place. The city becomes the ghetto, and that's, you can see it. The ghetto becomes even more ghetto in cities. The stress of the allure of cities is fading. New York had its heyday up to about late 60s when the youth culture started happening. That polluted the world from the adult's point of view. That polluted New York City. You know what I mean? These kids walking around with hardly any clothes on and dirty and barefoot. And I've talked to many people. I was in New York and then. You know, everybody, look at those images in the 50s. They'd go to New York, and they'd wear nice hats and dresses and suits. It was a big deal to show up and go to a film or the opera or symphony, right? It was middle class, going to church kind of stuff, but it's the cultural church. And New York had a big magnet in the 1560s as the middle classes were starting to get the abundance of the 50s after the GI Bill in the States. So that's what I'm communicating here. The the nation is becoming threatened, and the city has become a dropout. Okay?
Yeah. And you could actually see that when you went to New York.
Yep.
That was the time that I was going to Princeton, just outside of New York. I spent a lot of time in New York. And it was just amazing to see the deterioration of Harlem and the Bronx, only a couple miles away from, United Nations, Upper East Side, fabulous wealth.
Midtown.
You could see the city falling apart.
Yeah.
Right? Brooklyn was falling apart. There was no investment in the outer boroughs at all. The city at once represented this magnet you're talking about, but anybody that actually looked at what was going on with the megapolis could see that it was disintegrating.
Yeah, and McClure commented on it. He said the city was obsolete. At best, they would be museums for people to play in. And he did say in some letters there'd be conflict between, in particular in New York City, between the Jews and the African Americans. He saw that coming, in these tribal conflicts due to money evaporating and all the effects of the actual computer environment coming in. So I'm showing you have to know a little bit about history of what you should know to understand why the city is a ghetto. It totally fits what I'm doing there.
Mm-hmm.
And then McCarthyism is the paranoia. It's almost like McCarthyism is is radio content in the TV environment. You know what I'm saying? It's radio paranoia, which was not so conscious in the radio era. Everybody was paranoid and they didn't know it. But it became a figure in the 50s as TV came in. Follow what I'm saying? That's a symptom.
Sure. Yeah.
So, and then you have the first half of the 60s is Beatles, Norman Mailer. The second half of the 60s is psychedelia. That's Marshall McLuhan. You have black and white TV in the first half of the 60s is, it's an art form. Color TV is making it an art form. But I'm including color TV as an art form because it's affecting people rapidly. And then psychedelics is taking the color mosaics of color TV and putting it into your brain, right? So that's playing with color TV inside the ground of the computer. And then the planet becomes what people think they're really living in. Their user is monarch of means that your sensibilities, you're thinking, I can go to any part of the world with a jet plane. And the computer is being brought into, all kinds of advanced technological corporations. So planet is the archetype. The nation is a dropout. And you have the figure, JFK assassination. I like to say that part of the reason Kennedy was assassinated, there was all kinds of reasons, was being on TV and having the power of that with his press conferences, no one, and being charismatic, no one had seen that kind of political charisma or power. And I think it threatened the Big Brother people. They said, this Kennedy is getting on a level of influence that goes beyond what Big Brother thought it was controlling. So that's the figure. It's a TV effect and a computer effect, the JFK assassination. Isn't that clever?
Sure.
And then 10 years later, Watergate. And you see, it's obvious, the popular art form is punk rock, new wave, Saturday Night Live, the TV show, and cults. Cults is like trying to retrieve for the chemical body human scale, community. You know what I'm saying? After the global phenomenon of television and computers. The computer is the interior landscape being enhanced. So the Club of Rome, you know what they are? They were the European intellectuals who started the fear of the ecology and pollution and all that. Do you know about them?
Right. Oh, yeah, sure. That was Ehrlich.
That was what?
Robert Ehrlich at Stanford was the guy that was talking about that stuff. Oh, Limits to Growth was his book.
Right. Well, that was The Meadows. The Meadows, I think, did Limits to Growth, but maybe Ehrlich was an advisor on it or something. But the Club of Rome, when they came to get to recruit McLuhan to the ideology, he says, no, you guys are the Club of Ruin, R-U-I-N. Did you know about that?
I've seen something like that in his stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So he wasn't fooled by, he knew that ecology and pollution, overpopulation were figures, you know. There was a ground effect that's going on that the elites of Europe, the Club of Rome, the guy Agnelli who ran Fiat car company, he was a major guy in it. It turned out later it was the P2, a lot of secret societies, agents in Italy. We're involved with this Club of Rome. The Club of Life was Lyndon LaRouche's reaction to the Club of Rome. So nobody really knows about the Club of Life, but that was a little point I put in there because LaRouche was spreading around the globe his journalism and his network. So they were the Club of Life. And then genetic engineering is a technological art form. It's the interior landscape of the body, the physical body. And, of course, see, it's quite mechanical, what I'm showing. But McLuhan is mechanical on the introductory level. You know, you just take the previous environments and stick them into the technological art form, right?
Yeah.
And the solar system becomes, that's an interesting pattern I'm pointing out. Solar system becomes a ghetto. You start to have science fiction movies of no more romance of outer space. Going to the moon, there's battles with the moon. 2001 comes in 68. Some of the movies in the 70s and 80s showed quite a corrupted lifestyle in spaceships or in colonies. You have, what was it, Solaris? That famous Russian movie, Solaris, I think it's called.
Yeah.
1972, where, you know, other novelistic phenomena are being introduced into space, right? We just, the problems of Earth start happening out in space. It's no longer the romantic thing, fantasy. So that's the solar system as a popular archetype of, and the planet becomes a ghetto, and that's ecology. And then you have Watergate. Now, the final one, the Second Coming, that's an idiosyncratic point, but for some of what I mean, but not all of it. The Second Coming is this incredible implosion of the global theater, and all kinds of fantasies happen, all kinds of movements happen in the 70s and 80s. Remember Pope John Paul II. Becomes a big phenomenon in the 80s. He's seen as a second coming for the Catholic religion. He's got youth all over the world interested, renewed fanaticism about involvement in the icon of the Catholic Church. And Reagan is doing that in politics. And, of course, they're also very controversial characters, right? They threaten people. So Furry Lint is a play I made in 1984. Who's Forgotten Furry Lint? And that was based on the attack on Larry Flint, who created Hustler magazine. And he had been shot in 1978 because he had bought the Los Angeles Free Press, put a big issue out of investigating who killed Kennedy, and that led to him being shot in 1978. Mm-hmm. So he was paralyzed in the wheelchair for 5 years and in pain. But then he had surgery, which made him impotent, but he no longer had pain, so he had new energies to do stuff. So he really started, he was still making lots of money anyways, so he decided to create a competitor to Time magazine called The Rebel or The Rebel, can't remember. And I knew May Brussel at the time, and Larry Flint met May and said, wow, you're the journalist I want. and made her editor of the magazine. This is 1983, but there was other jealous people, and there were struggles within the magazine. So May never became the editor in chief because of other people. But the point is that what happened to Larry Flynt is he started side to run in late 83 for president. He was arrested, charged with this and that, and put in a Rochester, I think it was, mental hospital for almost like political prisoners in America. And he got sideswiped all through 84, and other people came in and took over his organization, and Hustler magazine was never the same. So Larry Flynt, I changed to Furry Lint. And what I have, what I mean by that is charismatic people. You could think of, what's that guy, Sharpton in New York City, definitely cult leaders, rock stars, movie stars, people who have a huge impact and get political. They are like lint on the global theater's fabric or clothes, and easily flicked off. So, mm-hmm. So you have
looks
a lot.
Like Malcolm X.
Yeah, he's an early furry lint, and even yeah. John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. Anybody who starts to become charismatic and looks like he's upsetting the establishment. And McLuhan, in his Forces Hydro magazine, 1973, that really great interview with him, he talks about the Kennedy assassination and how foolish it is to try to change the establishment or threaten the establishment. He understood that those kind of humanist movements were not really going to work anymore. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So that's the furry lint syndrome, furry lint. And the art form that people think that they're part of, McLuhan talks about in Take Today, the TV viewer starts to think of themselves as a king or queen in all that he surveys. You know, it's just getting so abundant and convenient for people to have access to great amounts of entertainment that they're beginning to accept and live and be molded by the mass man idea, the instantaneous access to everything. McLuhan later called the super angel. So you have the furry lint is the intellectual art form. Some kind of educated person thinks they got the key to everything and starts getting politically motivated. But it's up against the popular effects of the second coming, which are Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II. So the second coming, according to the Evergreens, the entities channeled through Michael Blake Reed that I engaged through the 80s and 90s and 2000s, and I always like to point out McLuhan's family went to the Evergreens one time in 1976, they described the second coming as a time of perpetual change. And I thought that was really useful. I mean, definitely fitting its wake, and McLuhan are pointing out a time of perpetual change. And so that was another meaning of second coming I was including. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I'm following what you're saying, and I like the dynamic of the thing, right? It's what you do is follow changes over time.
Yeah.
Where the changes sometimes represent an attempted solution, and other times represent a dissolution.
Yeah.
Right. And
exactly.
You follow that dialectic, and I think that's right on.
Right, and furry lint. You know, once you had the global theater, someone becomes famous. My God, they're over the whole planet. I mean, Caesar never had that. Nobody had that before. It's a new phenomenon of second coming mythical proportions, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And then they're up against the discarnate super angel, the mass man, who's still passive. Haven't gotten into the interactive digital, really. It's starting to, mm-hmm. but It's the cable TV era.
Right.
So the
there's some humor to this, right? I mean, the mass man, a.k.a. Angel, in reality, is just somebody that needs to buy a certain deodorant or a certain soap or something.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, so good.
Okay, so I have the universe is art form, or people think they're the living in it, and that's the Star Wars movies, Star Trek, also the New Age, the Shirley MacLaine phenomenon of people, you know, stoned on ayahuasca or something, getting cosmic visions of themselves, right?
Yeah.
Cosmic narcissism, you could say. That's part of a popular second coming. And outer space is a complete ghetto. I can't remember some of the movies. I can see them, but there's all kinds of disastrous scenarios in outer space, right? Going beyond the solar system. It's a dangerous place. Now, you have Watergate in the satellite phase, the penultimate level, but then in second coming, you got the Battle of the Harvest Moon. That, nobody knows what that is. One or two people on the planet knew Dr. Beter, but it was actually an event that Beter maintained happened. The Rockefellers, who had always had a secret alliance with the Bolsheviks throughout the 20th century, and he was involved in that levels of intelligence, so he claimed to know about this through his experience, they started to get paranoid about each other in the mid-70s. So this is the beginning of the global theater, the global membrane. Somebody could hijack the whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's getting too tiny. And so the Rockefellers and the Soviet Unions that come out of the global village, the electric phase, they go at each other. It's a race to the moon, and the Russians get there first, or the Soviet Union, and they put their particle beam up there, and they knock out some of the Rockefeller satellites. There's a famous battle, September 27th, 1977. That's the Battle of the Harvest Moon. So it's part of the universe, or even outer space. You're getting corporate battles that we saw in the 19th and 20th century are now starting to happen on the moon. Okay? So that's a symptom.
Yep.
The action has moved off the planet for secret power struggles.
Right, right. So let me just try to describe from my point of view what you're doing with something like the Second Coming. The line before that, the satellite line, has precipitated certain possibilities and certain problems. And so what you have is with certain people, you have a positive or negative realization of new possibilities, like Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul.
Yeah.
On the positive side, and on the negative side, the furry lint type people. And then for the ordinary guy, the precipitate is mass man, angelic man, whose mass seems to be very large, but actually it's very small. There's a great difference between how the mass man conceives himself and what he actually is. And that'll be part of problems that get precipitated to the next line, apparently.
Yes.
So then with the universe, you have both a positive and negative result from the satellite line of what thought can do, right? So you have the positive realization you were talking about with Shirley MacLaine and folks like that is a kind of universal vision that somehow includes them.
Yes.
And then on the negative side, you have a universal vision that doesn't include people. And
right.
So both of those are going to precipitate problems in the next phase. I guess that'll be the global membrane.
Yes.
As I see the way you're looking at history here, technology is one way of seeing how problems become concrete in history, but at the same time precipitate out problems that are going to have to be solved on both a technological and non-technological level at the next phase.
Yep. So, exactly. And so what I did was didactic, you know, doing basic McLuhanism, but showing where these, what he was really doing, the interacting of all these different institutions, which were the past institutions, that was his later definition of the medium. So I'm showing the figures, under the figures is the medium that's being affected by the ground, the new figure, even though it's a ground effect, like television.
So one way of saying what you were doing in the mid-80s is that you were trying to capture in a slightly different form how McLuhan's mind worked.
Yeah, I was showing a portrait of McLuhanism, and, you know, it's a very informed, up-to-date, and accurate presentation of how McLuhan looked at things.
Okay.
But nobody understood it. Doing a lot of explaining of it. But after I explained it, people could get it. But it's funny, they couldn't see it. They weren't used to looking at something that would be figure ground. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly. Well,
yeah.
the great problem that we're talking about here still exists today in spades. and it is that people are completely unable to see their own identity, their own way of looking at the world as a figure.
Exactly.
Right? As something that isn't fixed or stable. And that's why getting tenure or getting recognition from your quote-unquote colleagues is so important. And these things act as sheet anchors against the storm of life.
Yep.
And so what you were able to do in the mid-80s is that you were able to understand the dialectic of figure and ground in a way that didn't threaten you. And that's exactly what people still haven't understood.
That it's not threatening, you're saying? I don't threaten
people.
Yeah,
the dynamic of figure and ground that's always going on and that's always undermining everything is, either can be taken as so threatening as to not be recognized at all, which is what most McLuhan scholarship demonstrates.
Yep.
Or if you expose yourself to it and allow yourself to live through it, you could come out the other side with a new sort of equanimity, a new way of going with the flow, you could say. And
I like to say a new poise.
Absolutely. And McLuhan talked about poise a lot, of course.
Yep.
And that poise gives you a certain humor, right? If
there's
an absurd aspect to all of these changes that go on. It's like the stock characters of the Italian theater that keep thinking that what they're doing is original and new, but they themselves aren't original and new.
Okay, correct. Now, I put in Second Coming. That's a perverse, eccentric thing to put in as a technological ground. But I actually thought I knew something by that. I thought I was. I had an important new way to look at religious experience due to technological factors. And the global membrane merging that was going on, for all intents and purposes, that's a... And McLuhan said in Playboy, we have a technological version of the body of Christ, right?
Yeah, I don't think he was very serious there.
No, he said it was ethereal and a sham, but...
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but the popular, you know, 300 years before, whatever people, they fantasized Jesus coming back and everybody transformed in some world, they didn't know that was going to happen to them electrically, you know?
Yeah.
So I considered what I did there a post-painting music opera. I consider that an incredible art form, what I made there, a modern painting, a modern mathematical formula, especially as it interrelates with the other chart, top-down identity. You know what I mean? This was useful. And maybe at first it has to be requires some sophisticated training and perception, but I would see this as important. It should be in every high school class, senior year.
Tell me this, Bob: was when you were working on this stuff, were you working on something that was past in your own biography, or were you working on something a little bit like an artist in a studio? Where this was sort of an ongoing processing in your own mind?
A lot of it was what I knew, so it was rearview mirror in my mind, but it led to new developments that I didn't foresee.
Yeah, so it had a, in putting down what you knew, you were able to precipitate out stuff that you had to know.
That's right. Did you say hadn't known or had to know?
No, had to know, that you were being led to know.
Yeah, and the lucky people who got these charts, they profited from it, you know, because they could see it. They were living it, and they didn't know it. And it was pretty obvious once it was explained. And they, wow, look at this, pretty comprehensive. So it would enter their conversations with people, you know. They'd cite these Mailer and McLuhan as examples.
Were people doing that in a way that you thought was correct, or were they taking this and largely distorting it, using it as markers where you had intended something dynamic and they were using it as something fixed?
They were novices. Nobody really was good at
that's
it.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
And nobody stuck with it. They were too distracted by second coming implosions and new versions of the second coming. You know, people couldn't stay attentive on anything. They just moved from one. I call it metaphysical promiscuity. That's what people, the baby boomers, created. Metaphysical promiscuity, hopping from one inspiring intellectual, the mind is art form, as William Irwin Thompson said. People jumping from one mind pattern to another.
Right, but without understanding the process.
Right. Totally somnambulistic.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the beginning. So then in the 80s, there was starting to be interest in conspiracy thinking, conspiracy theory. It wasn't called conspiracy theory in the 60s and 70s. They it's called journalism. But, of course, Barry Nevitt did a tetrad on news, and it flips into the news behind the news. That is the result of the global theater. So the news behind the news is what people get interested in, and then that becomes conspiracy research or conspiracy journalism or actual historical proven theories, phenomenon, that, of course, get popularized because the mind was, in a way, obsolete, got popularized in the 80s, and especially in the Internet. It was just more rampant pattern recognition was really what the phenomenon was. McLuhan nailed it in the 70s with that phrase. He called it the increasing cognitive thrills of pattern recognition. And that became, on the internet, conspiracy theory. So anyways, because this was happening in the 80s in Toronto around me and the information I dealt with, I made a technological chart showing the ground of figures of conspiracy.
And are we moving here to the top down?
Yeah.
Okay. One question that I noticed that the bottom up chart has secret government as its ground, and then top down chart also has secret government as its ground. Does secret government in these cases, does that mean something like the hidden dynamic that is driving the changes, like that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The secret government in the top, the bottom up, which is the figures are the cultural heroes in the West, the constitutive factor is not a person, it's technology that's conspiring against the medium or the traditional setup of a society or culture. So I'm saying it's a technological secret government. You're shaped and governed by the media of your time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pun, I guess you'd say, on secret government. But the cliche meaning of secret bureaucrats running the show is what is meant in the top-down chart. It's the power bureaucracy in the West. So I run through almost the same aspects of the bottom-up chart, the same periods, but with humans being the ground, right? So at the time of Rome, the Illuminati, the time of the printing press, Venice, time of industrialism, the family trust, or what's called in Italy the fondo, the fund. And then you get the global village moving into global theater, the League of Nations. And then that's redone as the United Nations once you get into full-blown global theater. Now, note in 1960, when man is becoming both figure and ground, it becomes technology. The secret government flips back into the bottom-up chart, but it's more geared towards a military operation, military control, laser beam. And that's going to lead to the Battle of the Harvest Moon in 1977. And then Mass Man is a military operation, and the Second Coming is a military operation. You see, it's people hijacking what technology does, and they actually become the technology. That's what's happening in the global theater.
They're hijacking the technology, and behind their backs, the technology is hijacking them.
Right. And to keep it within bureaucratic power, because on the bottom-up chart, technologies are affecting all over all kinds of society and different media and different pasts and different futures. Laser beam is a particular technology, services in 1960, and it's a military operation. McLuhan said by the 1970s, the elites, and he was always talking to the triggermen, he called them. He knew there was a, quote, secret government. There had to be. It was a practical necessity, government by committee, you know, just the way the dynamics of somnambulistic economy is, requires that. So he said in the early 70s, what was I saying? He said, TV was a threat at the time of, say, JFK, 1960. It threatened the internationalists. That's the term for them in the 20s and 30s. The cliche Rockefeller, Morgan, Bolshevik, say. He says in 1970 that the elites realized, wow, this television saves us a lot of effort to propagate like Big Brother and make people believe certain ideologies, certain ideas. They don't need to believe in anything as long as we keep giving them new environments to stimulate them or massage them. And he says that in that 1957 article, God Making Machines, he said we move from social control through morals and mythologies to norm functioning, cultural norm function.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah. That's actually 54. That's a review in Commonweal. And what's interesting about what you're saying there is that McLuhan had been talking about advertising in those terms.
Yes.
For a long time, since at least 1947.
Yep. Well, 43, 44, I think meeting Lewis got him into it at St. Louis.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Certainly in the 40s, McLuhan, in large part, I guess, through Lewis, was trying to think through how thought was being controlled by the illusion of thought.
That's right. Not by people.
Pardon me?
Not being controlled, not by people. Being controlled by cartoons and ads and, media phenomena.
Oh, right. But the ostensible message of Time magazine or of the advertisements, etc., was how much in charge you are.
Yeah.
Right? So as you were being led around by the nose, the ring in your nose was what a great, intelligent, independent being you are.
That's right. You know, in Cultures Are Business, he has like a kind of a truck driver guy who probably didn't get beyond high school. He's got a tuxedo on and he's going to the opera. It's the Cultures Are Business theme. You know what I mean? He's putting on the aristocratic airs of the educated of the 19th century. And it's what he does when he goes on a date or something.
Yeah.
There's an image of that particular guy in Cultures Are Business in one of the ads.
Sure.
So now how do we get onto that? What were we talking about? Oh, about 50. Now, the God Making Machines is 57. What is he written in 54 that goes into cultural norm functioning?
No, the God Making Machines essay was 1954. You have the wrong year there.
Okay. What about, Project Subliminal? That's 57.
I think so. That was in the Canadian Forum.
Yes. Yeah. He has five. He asks, what is running the show here? He says, national myths, is it national myth making, collective phobia, cultural norm functioning, or individual sensation? Those were the four in that article. I think it was that article. But God Making Machines, I thought that was 57. But okay, same time as Catholic Humanism.
Yeah. That in 1953, 1954, he published, I think, four different articles and reviews in Commonweal. And
one of them was Sight, Sound, and Fury, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Commonweal is a Catholic magazine, and his Catholic Humanism lecture was given at St. Joseph's in Hartford. And so McLuhan in 1954 was making an attempt to kind of establish his credentials in the Catholic community, but at the same time kind of attacking that community.
Yes.
It was sort of a failed venture. He gave it up.
Yeah. I wonder if he started it again in the mid-70s, started to complain about Gnosticism.
Absolutely. Well, he was complaining about Gnosticism right at that time in 53, 54. So his letters to Eric Goodland, for example, are explicitly about that. And he also has some letters to Lewis about Gnosticism, and then in his review of Kenner's book on Lewis in 1955 is his definitive statement on Gnosticism, which ends by saying, let us go and rejoin the One.
Yes, and that's Eric Voegelin, who was a bit blurred out for my hearing, so it's V-O-E-G-E-L-I-N, something like that, Voegelin.
Right. So the German pronunciation is Voegelin.
Voegelin.
That's why it seemed blurred, yeah.
Okay. Know,
in English, we have a hard time with the umlaut in German.
Right.
It's like Hölderlin.
Yes. So what you were just... Oh, yeah. So, yeah, he doesn't talk about Gnosticism too much in the 60s, early 70s, but by the mid-70s, he's talking about it in interviews again. I have a few interviews where he brings it up.
And talking about the value of life and anti-abortion and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it was kind of another wave of trying to reestablish a tie between his work and the church.
Yep. And he had just been named an advisor on communication media or something in 73 by Rome.
Yeah.
So
correct.
He had to talk their language a little more. So so we're looking at the top-down chart. You can see we got figures, but not as many as the bottom-up, because it's the bureaucrat world. So the popular government or front for the elite, which is secret, Rome at the time of Christ, House of Habsburg at the time of the printing press, Britain in the 19th century, and then America, the Rockefellers in the Morgans in the 20s. So you have a technological government at the same time. The spoken word is a control factor for bureaucrats. You've got to believe one religion or talk up one god and can't talk about others. They started to police it, right? That's the effect of the phonetic alphabet. And then the printing press leads to the government of manuscript. Now note, this is a bit behind. See, the technological government at the time of industrialism is the previous technology, which was ground once, the printed book. Now this gets into science. Why science takes over? Because it's the rigidification of visual space. McLuhan says that when a new environment comes in, the previous owners, they freeze on the controls. These are media that are becoming frozen for policing actions by the elites. You see what I'm saying there? Technological government.
Yeah, absolutely. And these things are subject to a strange dynamic themselves. So the spoken word throughout the Roman Empire, you have commands and laws issued in Latin.
Yes.
And the possibility of this, according to Innes, is paper and the availability of papyrus. So you have, in each one of these technologies, you have the utilization of a technology that's known, that has the seeds within it, overthrowing itself.
Overthrowing itself, did you say?
Yeah, overthrowing itself.
Yes.
So the spoken word is actually a government of the written word. And the manuscript in 1500 is actually
government.
The multiplication of written stuff.
Yes.
That already has printing built into it. Printing has actually already started by 1500. And so the although it seems like you have government by reams of paper that are going around, actually you have a government that is subject to overthrow by the technology that is sort of hidden inside how you're governing.
Exactly. And you know, McLuhan says mechanical bride, why does a journalist have charisma? You remember that statement or question?
Yeah.
And why are we involved, you know, fascinated by the activities or role of the journalist? That's partly, when I put these things together, I've got quotes from McLuhan in my mind. You know what I mean? And that quote is why newspaper, and people were fascinated because the journalist was becoming a new kind of a government.
Yeah.
Top-down bureaucratic control level. So you have in the 40s and 50s increasing censorship of radio and movies. In the 60s, television has stopped from being live. That was a new kind of control. And the computer, what would have been, well, certainly the idea before 1984, where the famous Apple ad, you know, announces the computer now is free for you to whoop the asses of IBM. But in the 70s, people thought, in the late 60s, they thought that they were being controlled. Remember, McLuhan had that line, don't findle, fold, or mutilate. People thought that the computer environment somehow was not necessarily watching them, but monitoring them. Mm-hmm. Right? It was the new image
Absolutely.
Of government.
Yeah.
And then in the Second Coming, you have a battle. If some mythical entity actually showed up on the skyline, like a hologram, and was beaming there over everybody, there might be arguments over whether it was a UFO or a hologramic projection on the sky. There'd be all kinds of arguments over what the hell is this phenomenon if it showed up as a power dynamic, someone that everybody, we got to listen to this guy. We're going to have to follow what he says. He knows a lot more than us, you know. So that's the satellite government, that popular image of government coming out of space, out of outer space, and taking over the planet. The Church of Subgenius, their book in 1983 had that on the cover, a parody of that situation. And among conspiracy people, you're saying something?
No, I just wanted you to enlarge on that. I'm not familiar with the image, but it sounds like it might be interesting. What did they show on the cover?
Okay, so you can, when you get a chance, Google Church of the Subgenius, S-U-B, capital G-E-N-I-U-S. It's not O-U-S, just I-U-S. So you will see a picture of, actually, it was based on my father, but a handsome 50s ad man kind of face is coming over suburbia, and you have people doing their domestic activities in their homes, reading the paper, listening to radio, watching TV, kids playing baseball, a suburban pastoral situation. And there's Bob's head, and J.R. Bob Dobbs' head, and behind him are, you know, the cliche image of the UFOs laser beaming, blowing up houses, right? So it's a UFO invasion scenario. And but it's led by just this head, which is called the Dobbs head for J.R. Bob Dobbs. And this handsome 50s Mr. Beaver kind of guy is leading. He is the interface between the aliens and the humans, and two-thirds of humans are not qualified to be saved. One-third are, and they're the subgeniuses. And they're going to get on those vehicles, those UFOs, and there's going to be all kinds of sex goddess virgins on them for you. That's what was promised by the Church of the Subgenius. And
yeah.
I don't know when the idea of the 72 virgins of the Muslim religion, how real that is, or, you know, remember that was promised to terrorists or something back in
the '80s,
late '80s,
still being promised, I believe.
Late '80s, early '90s, but they did this in '83. I don't know if they knew about this Muslim fantasy or Muslim fact, whatever they.
Maybe not. It could be a Jungian phenomenon of some sort of archetype of the collective unconscious.
Yes, they tapped into it, and so it's.
But let me ask a question about this. The I think the image that you're talking about. Maybe is the image you see all over the place of Bob with the pipe.
Yes. That's yes.
The okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, excuse me. So what this suggests to me is that the Bob meme might be taken to be the dynamic of the interface. Between practical, in quotation marks, normal, in quotation marks, life going on that you were talking about, reading papers, doing the dishes, playing baseball. And then on the other hand, this archetypal world of the outer space wars, I guess.
Yeah,
you would probably talk about the media wars.
Yeah,
but if Bob, namely a function that is not limited to you, but you are excellent at doing it, as illustrated by your name. Or is denominated by your name.
Yes.
If Bob can be taken as the shuttle, not only in the space term of shuttle or even the airplane name of shuttle, but in the use of shuttle in spinning thread. So. There has to be a shuttle between figure and ground that is perpetually changing them, which is taking what was a ground, making it into a figure, precipitating other problems, which include new grounds and new figures. And Bob can be taken as this intermediary dynamic. The medium that is the message.
Yes, exactly. It's the Take Today, page 11, where man becomes figure and ground.
Yeah.
And in the interval. Now, what's amazing is that, I'll just put a personal note in here, that prediction by the Church Subgenius, using an image that was based on my father's face, and anybody can see this at dobstown.com. Just go there, scroll down slightly, and you'll see the flipping back and forth of my father's face and the what's called the Dobbs head, designed by people in Dallas in the early 80s. This has come true. Apparently, when Ion showed up, that was my role. One of my roles is to interface with the aliens, and I've broadcast what Ian says about this. I don't know anything about this. I'm not conscious of what I'm supposed to do. But the latest information is that the aliens are going to be talking like Finnegan's Wake. And since I know a lot about Finnegan's Wake, I'm qualified to get close to understanding them. And Joyce didn't know. James Joyce was actually encountering aliens. And that's where he got his Finnegan's Wake from. So that's the latest discovery here at the labs.
But aliens don't necessarily have to be figures that are embodying some strange matter and some strange language in a strange spaceship. right? Aliens can simply be the what we don't understand, but we need to understand. And so function of a medium is to go between what we need to understand and what we do understand, but only in a very limited sense of sort of going about our daily living and stuff. And the function of the medium is to work between those two so that the quote-unquote alien thought or the alien being comes to be formulated, you could say, or specified. And at the same time, so does what is going on in normal life because of the new information that's getting through the middle.
Yes.
Right? And actually, that's the same dynamic that you've been pointing out throughout these charts.
Yes.
Where an unknown art form is incipient in what is going on, but is not known.
Right.
And that incipience will eventually become revealed, but only to throw up a new veil with its own problems.
Yeah.
Right, and its own fascinations, and this kind of turn around, turn about, is the dynamic of history, and at its teeter-totter focus, there has to be a medium, and you situate yourself at that medium point.
Yeah.
Which can be called Bob because you have, with B-O-B, you have a B and a B that are actually different, but they're joined in the O.
That's right. And that's what McClone called himself, Center for Culture and Technology. That's a pretty grandiose statement.
Well, that's interesting. That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah. At a time when centers weren't really known at the University of Toronto.
That's right. They were popping up, but the people didn't know. And he writes about it in the mid-60s, about the new role of the center, you know, in the new city of the university, right? And he's actually avant-garde or one of the early recipients of that new art form.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So did you say whole and the B and B and the whole in between?
No, the O.
Oh, the O in between, right. The zero. And see, that's B is the second letter, so that's 2-2. And McLuhan is number 22 on the later chart we're coming to. So that's some of the reasoning. Definitely the people who wrote the Church of Subgenius, I had told them some things, but they had a smattering of – they were smart artist kind of people, and they're even written up in High Performance magazine – but they have the tetrad, a crude tetrad in there in 1983. They have other patterns of other knowledges, and they have references to James Joyce. So they were picking up. It was an avant-garde phenomenon with perfect pitch for its time, which basically...
And a lot of humor, right?
Oh, it's constant humor. They used to say that we're a religion mocking religion. We're a business mocking business. We're science mocking science. We're art mocking art. They mocked everything. They're supreme manipians, which that's probably one of the first people to point out that McLuhan's society of the 80s, what he was predicting coming, was a population of manipians.
Yeah.
And they were a phenomenon of that. And you'll see they're on the later chart. Okay, so under symptoms, you know, you take some cliche images, slaughter of Christians at the time of Rome, Spanish Inquisition in the Armada, time of the printing press, Napoleon, the railway war, decentralizing monarchies, World War I, the industrial 19th century. Then you have the electronic radio era, Hitler, Stalin, radio war, decentralized Western empires. global theater, now you get into the information war, or what's called the Cold War, which is a TV war, which is World War III, which decentralizes world government. McLuhan used to talk about, one sentence, it's the age of paratroopers. You ever notice that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He talked about that, I think, in the 1950s, and then quoted it in Counterblast 69.
Yes. And that's what he called the CIA world, the James Bond world. You know, the power bureaucracy, Big Brother went inside. It was small teams. They could manage the global village, the global theater, not through empirical, you know, empire-sized bureaucracies. That was just natural. The environments grew to that size. But for controlling the flow of information or of what's coming next kind of knowledge, that was done by small teams. And, you know, JFK... just before he got assassinated, he said, I want to scatter the CIA to the winds. Well, he didn't get the chance to do it, but it was scattered to the winds anyways. And this factional fight surfaces in the mid-70s when George Bush is made director. And they fire a whole bunch of CIA people, seniority level, and replace them with others. And it became known as a battle between Team B, Team A, and Team B. That is a decentralization later on my chart here. So you got decentralized world government, decentralized Western empires at the end of World War II is the decolonization that supposedly happened, you know, in Africa, in Asia, the withdrawing of European empires. The decentralizing world government is the fragmentation and moving into outer space, a new ground. So that's what I'm trying to get at there. And then you got the decentralized solar government. That leads to the Battle of the Harvest Moon, because the secret solar government was the Rockefeller-Bolshevik alliance, but that falls apart in the 70s. What do we have? A decentralized universal government, left hemisphere and right hemisphere. That's when the society starts to have a war between the New Age and old science, and the figure for that is Carl Sagan. Remember his documentaries on science, on cosmos?
Very much, very much. He was a very Gnostic guy, but
yeah,
you know, I remember him well. Sure.
Yeah, so he was a figure. So by the 80s, he's saying, I'm very disappointed in the population. They're going for crackpot conspiracy theories, New Age fantasies, astrology. You know, he just represented the University of City, the policeman saying, where's our belief in science and, you know, real stuff and rational thinking?
Right, right. But so, he was talking about himself there, I think.
Because, oh, yeah.
Earlier he had been talking about intelligence coming from outer space and all that sort of stuff. And well, then when he got sick and was forcibly reminded of his humanity and his finitude, then he started to regret some of the stuff that he earlier said.
Yes, and it's also an example of the literate person in the ivory tower and the mob effect of electric pop culture swallowing
him. So if somebody were looking at a chart like this, I would say, well, maybe one way to think of it is that the middle column, which you call technological government, it might be thought of as an art form.
Yep.
And the art form is not at all restricted to art. It is a form of organization which has grown out of previous forms of organization. And then this art form can manifest itself in various ways. And one way is through the popular government on one side, and another way it manifests itself are the symptoms on the other side.
Yeah.
So you have particular history on both the two wings,
yes,
the left and right sides,
Yep.
And in the middle, you have the form of history, you could say, that's generating all these changes on the sides.
That's right. Well, the previous environment, people think it is the ground, but it's one phase
right.
back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So
yeah.
Part of the overthrow of any technology is people beginning to see it.
Yes.
It's already on the way out the door if people think that it's the latest thing.
And the bureaucrats of that increasingly obsolete technology freeze on the controls. They get rigid, inflexible as they go down. You know what I mean? So that's
sure,
what
sure.
we're...
So there's an inflexible bureaucracy that has a necessary opposition to it that has a new form of flexibility, right?
Yes. Yep.
Every time the art form is going to... There's going to be no such thing as the pure art form.
Right.
It's always going to have manifestations that are themselves dynamic and diverse.
Yep.
And it's this strange sort of multiple dynamic that's going to give rise to changes in all of the things, all of the manifestations that we're talking about at any given stage.
Yes. And what's interesting, it's epitomized in the Android meme tech body phase we're in now by the phrase deep state. The whole world has become conspiracy theorists, which is an interesting effect there of the obsolescence of the chemical body, maybe even the TV body, the freezing on the controls, and where everybody's up against the deep state. It's quite phenomenal what has happened in pop culture, you know. But you can understand it through McLuhanism.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, the left hemisphere versus the right hemisphere, that's in medicine. Carolyn went through this. The new technologies, say the subtleties of the global theater and then the global membrane, got people into what they called energy medicine and into acupuncture and Bach flower remedies, all these sensitivities, you know what I mean? This extra refinement of matter was an effect of the stages I'm showing on the chart here. So the left hemisphere of Western science froze in response to people. They started recovering voodoo or hoodoo and all these different things got retrieved. You know, McLuhan said in the mid-60s, or even in the 50s, that the occult got dropped into the lap of the first half of the 20th century due to electric conditions. Well, we have the battle between left and right hemisphere dropped into the lap of everybody in the 70s and 80s. So you can see that I'm updating McLuhan here.
You know, I don't, that's a little, the whole idea of updating is one that I'm not fond of, but I can see you applying McLuhan to new phenomena.
Yes, that's what I'm doing. I'm just using the McLuhan formula to what he wasn't around to do.
Correct. Okay. So updating in that sense, I can understand. Yeah.
Yeah. The, you know, he gets into the left-right hemisphere as maybe a ground to be taken seriously. But over the next 15 years, there's arguments in academia and science about the validity of that, those divisions, and then they become a pop culture art form, well, a comic strip in the 90s. And people go around, well, you know, I was left hemisphere yesterday, but today I'm working on my right hemisphere.
Right.
The turning of a serious new conceptual breakthrough into trivialities because of later changes.
Sure, absolutely. So the same dynamic that we've seen at all times, and this one's particularly funny, I think, because when McLuhan got into left and right hemisphere, he was quite sick. He didn't have many years to live, and he was looking around for ways to try to put his work into formulas.
Yes.
So the tetrad was one of these, and left and right hemisphere was one of these. And he was increasingly less able to see the humor in these things, right? So
yes.
When the left and right hemisphere became humorous and became sort of pop culture, as you were saying, it's what McLuhan would have seen earlier in his career as something inevitably funny.
Yes. Yeah, the absurd, what do you call it? The global theater of the absurd.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, let me think, what was I going to add to that? The so you're saying, yes, the humor. Also, it's incredible how simple his time was compared to today. I don't think people saw the overwhelming information overload to the degree, and then the multi-bodied situation that I called. They didn't see that coming. You know what I mean? Nobody saw this. Maybe Finnegan's Wake did, if you knew how to look at it. And he did, but it's like, you know, I wish Zappa was still alive to comment on everything and make music in response. We all wish that McLuhan would live through the last 30 years, right? What would he have been saying and doing? It would have been really interesting.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's one of your activities is to try to imagine that, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm carrying it on in public media like he did. So the final stage, now we're getting into the popular government is universal. This is the cults of Star Wars fans and Star Trek and all this other stuff that goes on, the blockbuster movies, right? That's playing with the popular government. We're all up against demons and reptilians, right? In the popular culture, that's the popular government. You know, it's not uncommon to think that you know, there's a whole school of thought that says Obama, as a young boy, was part of the colonization of Mars. This is what people think and talk about.
That's new to me. But,
oh yeah, no. Well, you know, McLuhan, he looked to fringe extreme behavior beyond what academics really would look at. I've kept that part of McLuhan going. I'm an expert on extreme fringe behavior. I've checked them all out. They're cliche for me, but you never heard of this little Lemurian dynamic, eh? You haven't heard of that?
No. But it doesn't at all surprise me.
Well, oh yeah, I wanted to say that a while ago, the visual space on the, go back to the previous chart, where is it? Bottom up, the moving from nation, planet, solar system, universe in the global theater, it is visual space, telescope space, so that, you know, in the final second coming phase, people project what their eyes can see to the furthest reaches of light years, you know? That's the popular imagination. That's in the bottom up. See, what's interesting, we flip into string theory, which is acoustic, right? Finally, they left visual space.
Yeah, but you can think of radio telescopes there as well.
Yes, and so let's see, we're back to the universal stage or the mythic stage. That's TV iconicity to the max. Global theater iconicity is government. Technology is a satellite, an old technology, and then you get these fundamentalist battles in all religions and institutions, including science and art, become fundamentalists, devil versus God, state versus church, Armageddon. McLuhan predicted that. He said we would become more religious. And he meant this kind of stuff.
Most religious age in the history of the world.
Yeah. And he meant this kind of pagan religion sort of thing. And it's always interesting to figure out what he meant by the phrase the true church that he thought he represented in the state versus church battles, devil versus God. So and Baudrillard writes a book, The Demon of Images or The Demonology of Images. So devil versus God is the increasing culture wars going on. So I could see that happening in the 80s, but I don't know if I saw it becoming as extreme as it became. I do have Armageddon there. That's pretty serious, or pretty destructive. Okay, so you see how it's easy to follow the chart now, right?
Yeah, I see what's going on, and I can translate it to my terms fairly easily. But let's just
now I want to go to the tiny note chart.
Yeah, yeah. But first, I want to know when you were putting down this top down, when you were writing the top down identity chart. Was this part of writing down the bottom-up identity chart?
Yeah, they're done at the same time in 1985.
So they're just sort of mirror images.
Yeah, they're the complementary. It's man as figure and ground. You know, this is what Take Today dealt with, both these levels. McLuhan didn't do it so much in Take Today, the mid-60s books, Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media about it. Then he went through the transformation of cliched archetype in 1970, and that got into the analysis of power. So I'm, you know, and when I'm doing this in the 80s, people don't know Take Today. You know, I'm avant-garde McLuhanite here. I'm way ahead of everybody pretty well, unless there's people we never heard of that were doing it, never showed up. But I know to have this interplay. You know, so Eric McLuhan says that he would discourage his father thinking in the Freemasonic conspiracies of the 50s in the 70s. He would discourage his father. But Marshall wasn't going to be discouraged because he knew that was part of the dialectic, you know, to include the power bureaucracy. And you know what?
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, so he told me through the Evergreens by around 1990 maybe that the kind of statements he made in Understanding Media where we soon are going to have the extension of the satellite, which will become the extension of consciousness. Remember that statement, 1964?
Yes.
So, and he said, you know, in 5 years this will be the case. So I didn't ask him. He brought it up. He said, I was off on one point or one level. I didn't understand that management could delay the technological effects, the changes, as much as they did. It got bottled up, you know. He just thought these developments would happen rapidly. And by 1969, he said, we're going to be able to take over the world. He said this in 64. In 5 years, we're going to use Madison Avenue to take over the world. If things kept happening at the speed he imagined was happening, yes, but there was the lockdown and the stopping of this stuff by management, he says. He didn't realize the Nixons and the Mafia and the actual conspiracy of the 70s of these bad elites taking over the globe and doing police states. And he has this great article in the Varsity Graduate of 1971, The Hijacking of Cities, Nations, and Planets. So management, he started to see management was hijacking things and you know, actually discouraging new breakthroughs, which were lurking, at least in rumor. He didn't think that he didn't understand or didn't he forgot to look at it. but he's saying that management was able to frustrate what he thought was unfolding. So go ahead.
From my point of view, the what's going on there is that McLuhan in the medium as the message phase was thinking that if you got a handle on the medium, then you will see a revolution in human affairs analogous to the revolution that happened with the chemical revolution after 1800. But what he didn't understand is that the just as with the chemical revolution, the it's not enough to understand something at a theoretical level. You have to understand its practical applications and ramifications.
Yes.
And McLuhan, in around 1960, let's say, didn't know enough about the ramifications and the problems that he would have to begin to understand in the 60s and 70s. He had to understand them both internally. This was a time of interior disintegration, and externally with the increasing problems that were occurring in the world that paid no attention to his discoveries.
Right, and, you know, he caught up, half caught up, thanks to Barry Nevitt. Barry Nevitt's experience of building the global village and the global theater, you know, in industry in South America. He said he dealt with Nazis in South America, former World War II Nazis. That was common knowledge in his experience. He worked for a Norwegian firm, I think. But he brought the efficient causality factors in the global theater to McLuhan, and that made the great book take today.
And I think at the same time, what Nevitt brought was this increasing evaluation, and later McLuhan, of Asian thought, so that instead of thinking that if we can get everything figured out, we can more or less in Western fashion get the world straightened out, he came to see that the world isn't subject to being straightened out. The world is always going to be subject to this figure ground dynamic, and we have to learn to be content with it.
Are you saying Barry helped him see that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Weren't Barry's parents were missionaries, weren't they, in China?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So I think that there's starting sometime in the mid 60s. There is an increasing attention paid by McLuhan to Asian thought and
Marxist thought.
Yeah, and to Heidegger through his friend Tom Langan.
Yes, and systems theory, which Barry came out of systems theory.
Right.
You know, general systems theory, Bertalanffy. You know, people don't know this about Barry. So we could say, you know, there was Carpenter in the early 50s. Then there's Scornia. Oh, no, let's go. Muller-Time, however you say his name.
Yeah.
Then Lewis and Gideon. Then, but on a personal interactive, you've got Carpenter, late 40s, early 50s. Carpenter gets alienated in the late 50s and leaves. And that's when Scornia comes in. And then that gets McLuhan on another level. And then maybe Daniel Capon, 64, 65, with the Global Thermostat Project and that big image in the May 64 newspaper. When Understanding Media comes out, you know, they have this big expo design proposal.
Yeah.
Remember that? You've
yeah.
seen that picture. And after that, after Capon and maybe Tony Swartz and New York people, in comes Barry. And so
yeah.
Barry is natural to be an important colleague after Carpenter.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Harley Parker was very important to him as well.
Yeah, Harley Parker is parallel to Carpenter, but, yeah, Carpenter's gone. So that leaves room for Parker to do Through the Vanishing Point. Yeah, Parker is important. Now, in 1971, I once talked to I interacted with Parker several times, but one time I called up the center and he was there and he answered. And in the course of his discussion with me, he said he taught McLuhan everything about art. He said McLuhan didn't know anything about art. He taught him. These people, Carpenter said the same kind of thing. People got inflated
yeah.
around McLuhan. It was almost like he was such a detached observer, they'd rush in to fill the void and thought they were creating it, you know, with their knowledge, their specialism
yeah.
that they brought to it. It was an interesting phenomenon that happened around McLuhan. I don't think Parker taught McLuhan about art. That's ridiculous. He,
right. But what he may have done is he may have helped prompt McLuhan to look into art as a way of developing his thought away from literature.
Yes.
Right. So it's certainly true that McLuhan met Parker in the early 50s. And then not too long after that, McLuhan started to get into the theory of art. So it was very influential to McLuhan in the 1950s to go through a whole series of art theoreticians like Gombrich and Ivins. Who was Gideon's teacher?
Burkhardt? No, Wolflin.
No, not,
Wolflin.
Yeah, exactly, Wolflin. Yeah. So all of these art theoreticians were McLuhan's way of finding another mode of explanation beyond his literary mode.
Yep.
And looking at art theory, and earlier he had looked at film theory, sort of through the influence of Pound, I think, that precipitated in the late 50s the idea that the medium is the message.
Yes.
Right? Parker probably was important to McLuhan in suggesting something, and then Parker confused the suggestion with the realization, right?
Yes.
He certainly didn't help with the realization.
Right. Now, it's the pattern I'm seeing here is it's incredible. McLuhan, you know, he used to have himself photographed in every department, but he actually did that. He'd meet some interesting genius, semi-genius guy, and he'd really learn from them or have them to bounce off to push his thoughts. And the people we listed are very important. And he's a modern thinker. Who was Heidegger dialoguing with people from different fields? Was anybody back from the Merleau-Ponty, you know, were they doing that? If they were professors, they might have. But McLuhan was roaming. He'd go to John Lennon, John Cage, and then the guy who came up with the left-right hemisphere. He'd correspond with him, you
right.
know?
I think McLuhan was more eclectic than most people.
Yeah.
Heidegger interfaced with Heisenberg and with physicists and musicians. an artist. So Heidegger was certainly able to speak with people and to be suggestive with people in a way like McLuhan, but Heidegger's thought works on a completely different level from McLuhan's.
Yeah.
So that's a topic we can get into at another time, maybe. But you're certainly right that what McLuhan was able to do, if we take his interface with Gideon, for example, he read Gideon. He thought, nah, this guy is right. But unlike Gideon, McLuhan then said, well, how can we realize this? How can I use my energy to try to bring this about?
And yeah, practical? Is that what you mean by getting practical?
Yeah. How can we put this together? How can we finance this? How can we find the people to interface with? But also, how can we think about this in other terms that may bring in other people to help? Right?
And, yes. He was always looking, he would say in his letters, I'm always looking for five people for a little community that he thought he could take over with.
Right. And that, it's one of the amazing things about modern life is that that idea is so strong and so obvious and so needed, and yet nothing is done about it.
Yes.
And the idea is simply that if you take a physicist and you say to the physicist, do you believe that the human mind can obtain truth about physical phenomena, right? And if the physicist says yes, you say, fine. Now I'm going to go to a musician and I'm going to ask him if he thinks that human beings have a truthful relation to music. And if he says yes, then I want to bring that musician and that physicist together, and I'm going to do the same thing for three or four other fields, and I'm going to ask those people to interface with one another and to try to define for everybody the human relationship to truth, right?
Yes.
And if you look at your charts, oftentimes what is going on is people unable to find truth in the crazy, catastrophic world that they found themselves in, and therefore they fall back into some attempt at fixation.
Yes.
Right? Which again, you know, gets overturned naturally, right?
Yeah.
So you could say that the history, the nightmare of history that Joyce was trying to awake from is the nightmare of people not being able to find common truth, right? And common truth both in the sense of a truth for everybody and common truth in the sense of what is the truth for everybody.
Yes.
So thing that McLuhan got from Gideon was that this is something that's possible and necessary. And he kept on working at that ideal with tremendous energy until his body broke down, basically.
Yeah.
And that story of what McLuhan was doing, I believe, is largely unknown. And yet it's the most important thing about him.
Yes, and we gave him the means to rebuild his body. He got it on like September 19th. The D-cell, which has led to our fantastic products. Ion showed us how to develop the D-cell into a new level. So we gave, Carolyn met with Marshall in September 19th, gave him the D-cell, told him how to use it, and it would have saved him on the health level, saved us back then. And the next Saturday, Jim Stewart, who knew of the D-cell, comes into the home. It's the morning after McLuhan has fainted or had his stroke, and I guess is in the hospital, and Jim is the janitor around the house, Marg Stewart, the secretary's husband, and there on the little table in the vestibule is the D-cell, unopened. It had not been cracked open. So he got to the promised land, but then, like Moses, wasn't allowed in. So I've studied and thought a lot about his health situation, especially since Carolyn became an advisor on it, and then helped Marg Stewart, and then Marg would tell us all these stories. So that's a story we can tell, McLuhan's collapsing body, if that's what you were referring to.
Well, I think I would tell the story a little bit differently than you would, but yes, I mean, it's the same story. McLuhan nearly always had health problems from the late 1940s on.
Did I tell you my theory earlier? Didn't I run through that? As each new technology came in, he got ill.
Yeah.
I ran through that with you.
So that, you see, in all of this stuff, what I see is a particular quality of mind that you have, and it's a storytelling mind, a mind that is able to make things concrete, that is able to see surprising connections.
Yeah.
And so you're a master of narrative. We might say. I think that we have to listen to that narrative and understand what's going on in it. I think there's two levels that are interesting there. It's interesting to me to try to understand McLuhan in that narrative. But I'm also interested in understanding you through that narrative.
Great. And I'm interested in understanding your understanding of my narrative and your narrative. I was going to say something. I have a vision. Oh, yeah. Beg your pardon?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You thought of it.
The final collaborator of McLuhan in the late 70s, nobody knows his story. I may have told you about it. His name is David Greenberg. He lives here in Maui. And maybe I told you this, so I won't go into too many details. It might be on a recording earlier. He became a lover of Mary McLuhan in 77 or so. And he was from a wealthy family in L.A., very involved in the art world. As a rich guy, you know, he's like a Gertrude Stein. He could host all kinds of scenes. Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty hung out with him, and that's how Mary met them. They would go to the beach in the 80s and read Understanding Media. But he ended up being over here, and then he went to Toronto to be with Mary, and he met McLuhan. And then he said he could do a TV series in L.A. He had the connections like Kenneth Clark's Civilization or The Ascent of Man by that guy, whoever that guy was in the early 70s. Remember those TV specials?
That was Bernowski.
Bernowski, right. So here he was. Marshall was right in 76 to 79 when he started to, you know, it's hard to stay at the University of Toronto. Trudeau gets knocked out. His support base is eroding. He's isolated. All of a sudden, this guy comes up with what McLuhan would love to do, a TV series. So they map it out, and everything gets set. And it's going to be maybe on the LA PBS station, because this guy had the connections to do this. And then he had the stroke. And so it didn't happen. But Mary, when I came here in 2008, Mary introduced me to him, and we got together and talked a lot about McLuhan. And he got inspired. He said, you know, Bob, you're the first person I've met who's like McLuhan. Why don't we put on a show at the Maui Arts Center where you come out and be McLuhan?
Uh-huh.
But that was
I can see that.
Right.
One thing I didn't understand, though, wasn't Mary in California then?
Yes.
You said some. you said something about Greenberg went to Toronto to be with Mary, but she wasn't in Toronto.
No, but she was going back and forth all the time. And Marshall, she said, I don't know if this is true or not, she said that Marshall always liked working with Mary because they got involved with Jerry Brown and Stuart Brand, and she got a job in the Department of Education for California. She said Marshall would get a talk. He'd say, somebody down there, you know, in Long Beach, get a talk for me. So he could go visit Mary. And I have their letters and I have their projects that they worked on that's in the archives with Jerry Brown. So she was the most active American part of the McLuhan family. Eric is in Toronto. But Mary is in California, which was a happening place, and she's very important for Marshall there. And they did a lot of stuff, and somehow she met Greenberg in there. And so he got so involved that he would come to Toronto to be with Mary, but also to work with Marshall. And a couple of times, Trudeau used to crash at their home when he came, you know, at the private Trudeau, he was still prime minister, but he could come to Toronto and hide out and do stuff in his personal life while being prime minister, and he would crash at the McLuhan home. And one time he called up, and Marshall, David didn't know who he was talking to, overheard this, where Marshall, no, I'm very busy, and I got to do this and that. Later, when David found out it was Trudeau, he knew that Marshall was really into his project, because he always welcomed Trudeau and enjoyed being with him. David had usurped that, and Marshall was getting ready to move to California to work and start a new operation there.
Yeah. McLuhan was a guest lecturer in Santa Barbara, in the middle 60s sometime, and really liked it. And
where was that? At the Democratic Institution's place?
No, it was you're right that that's where the institute was located, but McLuhan was lecturing at the University of Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara.
Did Hugh Kenner get him there?
Maybe. Kenner was away in Europe, so the two of them weren't together there. But
Kenner had been working there, right?
Oh, yeah, he was. That was near the end of his tenure there. He was about to leave for Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
But McLuhan took his whole family there, the same as he took his whole family to UBC a few years earlier. And there are letters in the published letters volume where he talks about how great it was in California and how we might like to relocate there. So what you're talking about from the 70s was kind of an echo of what he'd already thought about in the 60s.
Well, about 1960, Marchand describes, you know, McLuhan driving across the country with, I guess, most of his family to visit Santa Barbara. You don't mean that trip?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, well, that's 1960. And that's when Kenner is there.
I'm pretty sure that when he drove his whole family over there, he was going to stay for a couple months, and because he wouldn't just take his whole family over there driving, you know, for a couple days or something.
No, but it was his summer vacation.
That's right. That's right, and Kenner was not there. If you think he was, that's a mistake.
Okay, let me just see. I'm looking at Kenner's Wikipedia thing. Does it academic career? He's teaching at Santa Barbara from 51 to 73.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Hopkins 73 to 90, and then the University of Georgia 90 to 99. So he, in 1960, McLuhan goes out there halfway.
Correct. But Kenner had some sort of sabbatical in Europe.
Okay, so in a way, he offered McLuhan as a substitute for the faculty.
Maybe. Or there may have been an ongoing lecture series at the university, and Kenner suggested that McLuhan could be, that year's lecture. I'm not sure exactly what the mechanism was. It's hard to believe that Kenner wasn't involved in it in some way, but I do know that Kenner wasn't there.
Right. Okay. The point is that McLuhan goes out to the University of British Columbia after that, right?
No, he lectured twice in summer sessions at UBC. One was 1957, and the second was 1958, and it was in the 1958 summer session that he first talked about the medium as the message.
Right. And so you're saying he took his family out to that?
Correct.
So through Ion, talking to McLuhan through Ion, we talk about his second sight. That was triggered by an experience in British Columbia when he was young, and he went out there with his mother. It was like the beauty of British Columbia, sparked something in him.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe.
So he had... What?
He always... Remember that McLuhan always talks about something like second sight being operative in him from the very beginning in Winnipeg.
Yes.
So he talks, for example, in the Nina Sutton interview, he talks about how his father would ask him if what he was talking about, if McLuhan would get up at some sort of social club or something and
talk
about it. Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
The so Ion tells me this, or McLuhan through Ion, that he went out to British Columbia. In my sense of his biography, I didn't see how he got out to British Columbia in early years. But when I was at the archives in Ottawa, I was going through those early years, and I found a description or something of him being out there with his mother, probably when she was speaking and doing her performances, in his teens, maybe.
She had a brother there.
That's right.
She had two brothers, and one of them was the head of an experimental farm for the BC government just outside of Sydney, which is just north of Victoria. And so they went out to stay with the brother.
Wait, was that guy named Ray?
Yes.
Yes, I read stuff, letters and stuff about him, and I think Tom Cooper interviewed him or corresponded with him.
Maybe there are. I know that there are, even online, there is some memories of Ray that get into McLuhan being out there.
Right, so... That adds to it. I mean, I imagine it was with her traveling and performing they got out there. But yeah, definitely with the family out there. Yeah, that's another reason he was out there. So,
sure.
He liked the Pacific Coast environment, British Columbia, and then he certainly liked California. And he so he does Kenner's scene in 60, then he does British Columbia, and then he gets involved with Gossage and is out in California 65, 66, 67 a lot. And did you know that Mary, she had hitchhiked to Banff around 65, 66, and instead of going back to university, she went down to San Francisco, and then when she was there, she had no money. She called up her dad and said, hey, I'm in San Francisco. Do you know anybody? What should I do? And he said, go visit Howard Gossage. So she went there, and she lived with the Gossages for a couple of years, 66, 67, in there. And then she got married in late 66. So maybe it was 65 and 66. So she knew a lot about the Gossages in that period. And McLuhan would come out and visit. So, yes, Marshall got out to California as much as he could. And he almost got to his next phase, if he had survived, would have been in California.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, when you talk about him liking to go out to British Columbia or going out to California, part of this is just being a Western Canadian.
Yes.
Western Canadians feel a little bit uncomfortable in Toronto and in the East generally. There's just a kind of edge to life that is strange.
Yep.
And when you get back to any part of Western Canada, and all Western Canadian cities are mashes of other Western Canadian cities. So, for example, when you get to Calgary, half the people you meet are from Saskatoon or Regina.
Oh.
And when you get to Winnipeg, Edmonton, there's lots of people from Winnipeg. And then you get out to Vancouver and, half the town is either retirees or people that have been recruited out of the prairies.
I see.
So a Western Canadian feels a comfort in the West. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about Western Canada or Western United States. That is kind of a relief from the East.
Right. And as a result of the jet age, most Canadians we encounter here, and many has houses in our compound here, are from Calgary.
Yeah.
A major Calgary-Hawaii or Calgary and Maui interface going on.
Absolutely. I know people from Regina that also have places in Calgary, that have places there in Maui as well.
Yeah. And you're down there. You're part of the West Coast. You're in California.
That's right. When we met, I was living in, close to Princeton, and you were living in New York. But I was never comfortable in the East. I was in the East both for university and then I lived there for 15 years around the time that we met, and it was a great relief for me to be able to get out to the West again.
Right. I didn't know that you were living nearby in Princeton. Didn't come across at the time. So when we saw you in 98, how many years had you already been in Princeton, and how many after 98?
Well, I moved to a town, Boundbrook, near to Princeton. I wasn't doing anything with Princeton at the time, but I moved there in the late 80s. In 1988, I bought a place there, I think, and then stayed there until a little after 2000. So basically 15 years, and when we met, I was near the end of my tenure there.
Right, and what were you doing there? Is that when you were working for the digital company?
Yes.
With George Sanderson project looming.
Well, George was, because of our expertise in digital media, George was hoping that we could meld what he thought was his permission to do the Electric McLuhan with what we were doing. And I got together with Corinne to discuss that, and she was gung-ho, I must say, for that, and got...
Mady.
What was the name?
Mady.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I got Mady involved. But then I couldn't get my partners to agree to the financial... outlay that would be necessary, and so we never could sort of get the ends to meet, and I always regretted that George Sanderson never saw the realization of a project that he had really worked hard on and set his heart on.
I thought it was Mady's resistance. Could they have lowered their financial demand?
No, the basic problem was that the internet had only become a possibility a year or two before this. We had made the transition from CD to internet, and the possibilities before the company were basically unlimited, right? If you think of digitizing the tradition.
Yes.
And so we were working on Thomas and Wittgenstein and Leibniz and Hegel and Kant and on and on. And so I go up to Nova Scotia and visit with George, and then I go to Toronto and visit with Corinne. And then I come back and I talk to my partners and I say, look, we can do McLuhan. Let's do it. And they said, well, wait a sec, you know, where are we going to prioritize McLuhan when we're doing Hegel and Wittgenstein and Plato, right? And it was more the idea that the priority was just too low for my partners. And I've always regretted that I didn't say, well, do you mind if I do it on the side? Because I think I could have put that together. But
yeah.
I didn't think to do that. And then the thing sort of fell apart. But one of the big problems was that George thought he had a contract with Corinne, and Mady disputed that. So that's one of the hurdles that would have had to be overcome. But basically, my job with the publishing company was solving problems like that. And that would have, I think that would have been a fairly minor thing to straighten out if my partners had agreed that we should do McLuhan.
Right. Now, you said your job was solving those kind of problems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Were they a bit naive about the importance of McLuhan?
Well, they certainly didn't agree with me that he was very important in comparison to the other people
yeah.
that they were dedicating their budget to.
So that was in the Princeton area, 88 to 2002 or something, and then you moved to California?
No, first back to Chicago. I had gone from L.A. to Chicago. I was in Chicago when Obama was an aspiring local politician
yeah.
who was getting beaten in local elections. I was in Chicago from around 1985 to 1988 or 1989, and really liked Chicago. Chicago is a kind of western town. It's not an eastern town. And it's just got a lot of attractions to it.
Mm.
So then and oftentimes when I'm moving around like this, it was because I could do the internet job from anywhere, but my wife would get jobs that were tied to particular places like New Jersey or like Chicago.
Yes.
So we moved back to Chicago in sometime around 2000, and then in 2005, she got the opportunity to work in Orange County, and for me, going back to the West Coast was perfect.
Yeah.
And so we came back here.
And were you still working with the digital company?
Yes, until I retired maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years after we moved here. And I still own part of it, so I'm not entirely removed from it. I'm just removed from the day-to-day activities that I used to do.
So that's 2005. It's the last 15 years you haven't been employed in anything?
Well, it was 2010 or so that I retired. But I had always, no matter what I was doing, I always regarded my work as my way of financing my writing.
Right.
And my, you know.
Yeah.
So... I always had, you know, I was investing in the stock market and things like this as part of my need to, you know, keep my family fed. at the same time that I had my first priority, which was my writing.
Right. So you did the virtual company until 2010, and then you've been on your own since then.
Yeah.
Right. Back to George Sanderson. I knew George. I wondered, what was his expertise on McLuhan? He did do that book with Frank somebody, and dialoguing about McLuhan or with McLuhan or your interaction with him? What did you learn from him?
I don't know that I learned anything from George, but number one, George was a great guy that I liked being with. George had a lot of energy, so that he was a one-man band with the Andy Gnish Review.
Yeah.
George realized that McLuhan was an important Canadian thinker and was more in tune with McLuhan than most people.
Yeah.
And was George was interested in what you might call the application of McLuhan, right? How would understanding McLuhan change education? How would it change how we think about ourselves? How would it change what we write? And the review was a kind of reflection of that.
Yeah.
Right? It subsequently became almost exclusively short stories and poetry. But for George, it involved art. His son was an artist and often did covers for the review. There was poetry in there, but there was also theory. There was also reviews of deep stuff. So the review was a reflection of George's mind and of how he understood McLuhan.
Okay, all right. That makes sense. A point I wanted to make is that McLuhan's way of interacting with all the different specialties in the university and out in regular life or commercial life, I called it later metaphysical promiscuity, but the way people live today with the internet over the last 10 or 15 years, they can read a little anthropology, a little physics, a little this, a little that. The way McLuhan's mind was, in the sense that it was more doing this interdisciplinary, inter-experience documentation and observation, is why they anticipated how we live today.
Yes.
At least how our minds
yes.
are.
That's correct. But we're still, in the main, it's still being done as sleepwalking.
Yeah.
Whereas what McLuhan was doing since the 1940s, sort of a conscious promiscuity. He was following medium's lead to see the commonalities in things, or the disjunctions, for that matter.
Yeah.
But, he was a person that understood the kind of figure ground dynamic that you illustrate in your charts.
Yeah. Yeah, my chart is about that. So let's go to what happens 10 years later. So we have the bottom up and top down. And we go up to, how is this person? We're getting it reorganized. Table, that's not that.
Yeah.
Bob,
I wonder if what we should do is take that up.
Okay.
Another time. I'm not pressed. I could keep on going, but I feel bad for anybody that would be listening to this.
Yes.
They might be getting fatigued. We're into our third hour here.
Okay, we'll stop.
What I would say is why don't you give a kind of homework assignment, right? Why don't you look ahead to the next session and say, I'm going to talk about this chart and that chart.
Okay. All right. So what you would look at the Bob Dobbs formula chart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the last of the visual, and then underneath it says Bob Dobbs tiny note chart, and you click on that, and that's bigger. So looking at the Dobbs formula chart, if you it's organized around the characters of Finnegan's Wake, the family, and you scroll down to the third bottom line, the section from the bottom, third up, has Reagan as the political actor, but on the left it says homeopathic cliche probes. And then the next slot down, anthropomorphic physical. Those two rows become the tiny note chart. They're pulled out of the formula chart and become the tiny note chart. So that's what you can do. You can look at the structure, and it's, if you're really listening to what I've been saying, you can figure it out. It's not that hard. Yeah. Figures and ground. The ground is ALP, the female, on the left, and the top-down stuff is HCE on the far right. That's the bureaucratic power response. So I put the two charts together, top-down and bottom-up, in the formula chart. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure. And then the formula chart itself is two together.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
The chart and the tiny note.
Yeah, I'm saying the formula chart is the two bottom, the two charts from 10 years before 1985 together. The tiny note chart is an anticipation of the Android meme from 1960 to 1990. So the characteristics, the tiny note chart shows the mind of McLuhan, which becomes the mind of Dobbs, and exaggerated in the internet. So the Android meme is the ground to what's going to happen in the mid-90s, and the ground is 60 to 90. The tiny note chart is that outlay of 60 to 90, and it comes out of the formula chart, which is from 1750 to 2020. Okay, so that's the assignment, is to look at that, and should be able to figure it out. It's pretty straightforward. It's mechanically staged, one step to the next.
All right, well, I learned a lot about your own thinking and your thinking about McLuhan today, and I'll look forward to learning more about them the next time through these two other charts.
Okay, great. Yeah, it's fun explaining them. Okay, so we'll talk next week, same time. Thanks a lot.
Same time, same station. Thanks
a lot. Okay,
bye-bye.
See ya.
Yeah.